Thank you, Jeff, for talking to the History Reclaimed website podcast once again. I know that you've been looking at a concept that you call donatism. Now, that's a strange name. What is it?
Yes, well, it was actually a heresy of the medieval church, and the idea was that certain priests' sacraments were invalid because of who they were. In other words, because of who their identity was. And I'm getting a sense that we're visiting this idea all over again in the modern academy, because there are many academics who believe that certain other people's opinions are invalid because of who they are rather than what it is they believe. And the medieval church kind of outlawed this idea and made it heretical, because they realized that as soon as you open up the validity of priestly actions to anyone's interpretation, then anybody could be accused of being wrong simply because of who they were. And I believe that in the modern academy, we're running into the same thing. People can say very scientific and truthful things, but they get shouted down because of who they are. And I'm arguing, unless we outlaw this new sort of donatism, then we lose perhaps the ability to distinguish fact from fiction, and scientists can be shouted down and kept out of the debate simply because of who they are, even if their arguments are valid.
And does that favour clearly certain people? But also, what you're saying is it favours certain arguments.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I don't even necessarily want to get into the idea that certain people will be more favored because of this, although I think sometimes that's true. But yeah, certainly, certain arguments will be unfashionable simply because of where they originate from and who it is that's arguing them. It would be as if in the hard sciences, people who argue about certain mathematical equations or certain experimental findings are considered to be wrong simply because of who they are.
And you're interested in medieval racism and how it is interpreted or thought about now. Why is that?
Well, there's been a number of books that have come out recently on medieval racism. One called The Invention of Race in the European Middle Ages, another one called Black Metaphors, How Modern Racism Emerged from Medieval Race Thinking. And these make, you know, rather standard arguments. One argues that Europeans were racist because they didn't like Jews in the Middle Ages. And another argues that because medieval Europeans used metaphors about darkness and light, that this predisposed them to racist thinking later on. Now, we've heard these arguments for maybe 70 or 80 years, but what's different now is that in the current social climate, these things are gaining attraction, which they never used to get, and they've won many awards and accolades. And so I think it's worth taking up these questions again.
And you refer to certain authors, don't you?
Yes. Well, The Invention of Race is an author named Geraldine Heng, who now has a chair at a university in Texas, and then Cord Whitaker.
But it's the general concept that you disagree with, that was medieval racism, or can racism be tracked back to the medieval age?
See, that's just it. Until 5 or 10 years ago, the orthodoxy amongst almost every medieval historian is that you can't really use the term racism to describe what was going on in the Middle Ages, that things were actually quite different the way people thought, or it was quite different than how we thought since the 19th century. So the main arguments that are being made right now is that medieval Europeans were racist, of course, as we've just stated. But what really is a little difficult, I think, is that the implication is that there was a direct path from medieval racism to sort of antebellum slavery and apartheid. That's the implication. And the other implication is that medieval Europeans were sort of classically racist, as we think of in a late 19th century social Darwinist sort of way, involving phrenology and all this other sorts of ideas. And another accusation is, or implication is, that this has therefore been part and parcel of Western civilization since its beginning. Europeans were sort of stamped from the beginning, as Ibram Kendi would say, with racist thinking. racist, but Europeans were, by implication, exceptionally racist compared to other people around the world. When we know, for example, that medieval Islamic writers were often far more articulate in their anti-African racism than we find in contemporary European literature. Why I'm challenging these theories is because, they're presentist, they're teleological, so they argue that what we think now about race is similar to what happened in the past. And also, I mean, the argument that Europeans were particularly racist, I think, is also not true.
And you don't like the way that these authors have gone about their research either, do you? You think it has a literary tone rather than a historical aspect to it?
Well, that's just it. I think that the main accusation you can level against these books is that as trained literary scholars, these authors are claiming to do intellectual history. So they're claiming to do an actual history of ideas, how these evolved over time through chronology, when they're really trained as analyzers of literary text. And there's so many careful and beautiful intellectual histories of the Renaissance out there. For example, Quentin Skinner writing on medieval political thought, Ronald Witt writing on Renaissance humanism. These are the sorts of things that really get to the nitty-gritty of how medieval people actually conceptualize the other and things like that. But I'm afraid that what we're seeing here with the literary scholarship is people who deal in terms of trope, people who say that authors who wrote hundreds of years apart or hundreds of miles apart, just because they use similar tropes, are now evidence of some kind of general European conspiracy to think in a racist sort of way, which is something that most intellectual historians for the last 100 years have argued is simply not true.
It's a bandwagon they're jumping on.
Yeah, exactly. And so one of these authors, for example, Whitaker, argues that Chaucer was guilty of, quote, spectral racism, so spectral as in ghostly, because he didn't actually argue or mention anyone with black or brown skin, but because he used, what was it, the semiotics of fictive sleight of hand, that therefore we can argue that Chaucer was implicitly racist in this spectral fashion. So that's the kind of conclusions that we're often seeing in this kind of scholarship, and it's not what it says on the tin.
And of course, you could say a lot about Chaucer and feminism too, but
sure.
You're almost saying if there's a stone and you turn it over and you want to see something, you can see it.
Well, precisely. And so my argument is that we should really look at what is actually being said and the kind of sources they're being used, and that by most historians' standards, this doesn't constitute a real history of an intellectual concept.
And do you think that this telling of history in this way, you might in brackets say it was a fashionable way, a trope of today, as you say, that we're all racist in the Western world. But is there an impact of it? Does it undermine confidence in cultures?
Sure. Well, I mean, yeah, it's the impact of this is multifaceted, and it's difficult to categorize. I think that this kind of negativity, it gives a sense that Europeans have always been racist and therefore they're always going to continue to be racist. And therefore, it gives a sort of sense that compromise of the sort that we've worked out through the democratic process over the last however many centuries, that talking together using reason, using good faith, face-to-face conversation is not really going to produce real progress. And so it's almost a Chomskyist sort of idea that even if on the surface it looks like we've made progress, that actually this is just smoke and mirrors covering up the reality of oppression. And so it's a very pessimistic vision, I would argue, because it seems to indicate that no matter what we think we've accomplished, in fact, we've accomplished nothing. And on some level, it kind of undermines the whole Enlightenment project, the project of liberalism, and it gives people a sense of despair.
Might it also lead to conflict and social unrest? Doesn't it pit one group of people against another?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're already seeing that. I think that if people come to believe that Beethoven is evil or racist just because he was European and wore a wig, then pretty much every legacy of Europe before the year 2000 can be seen as part of the problem, part of the oppressing class. And this makes it easier to attack statues, to throw cans of soup on art. And the whole intellectual legacy of the Enlightenment, therefore, again, can come under attack and really, in the end, leads us that much closer to dictatorship, which is kind of really the only other option that we have besides, of course, liberalism and democracy.
So it really has serious consequences in your view. But what can be done? The publication of articles such as yourself, the History Reclaimed website, trying to put a more orthodox historical research concept on the table. This is a fight back, isn't it?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think that during the Cold War, Noam Chomsky and his crew, it was good that they were around. They provided radical critiques. They provided, you know, outlets for free speech. But at the same time, there was never a danger that their view was going to become dominant, that people were going to just give up on the democratic project altogether. I think in the age of social media, we were caught really unprepared. I think in the 1990s, Francis Fukuyama had kind of said, hey, well, it looks like liberalism is the only game in town. And I think a lot of people who during the Cold War would have gotten their hackles raised by the Chomskyites just put down their swords. And I think that with the rise of BLM in the 2010s, we were really taken completely off guard that this kind of thing would come back again, that ideology would rule the roost rather than facts and centrism. And so I think History Reclaimed is definitely in the vanguard of trying to reorganize resistance against a too radical, too ideological interpretation of history and of culture that's not really based on facts but more on feeling.
If I'm walking through a multicultural city in Europe, London or elsewhere, then I feel really proud to see people of different origins walking around me. In fact, when you go to the country, you can feel it's rather insular by comparison. But that's not what you're saying, is it? You're not arguing against integration. You're arguing almost in favour of it, but saying that these theories pit us against one another.
Yeah, well, precisely. I mean, I think that Obama's vision of a sort of colourblind world was one that we had pretty much almost achieved until the 2010s. I was certainly on board with that. I think the main thing we have to remember is that what really matters is science and facts. These are the main shields against too much ideology and basically witch hunting. And so as long as we live in a society where most people accept the basics of the liberal project, then we're going to see an increase of human rights. And it doesn't really matter who it is that is participating. The idea is eventually everybody will realize that facts and science and reason are kind of a good way to do civil society. So all are welcome, all have always been welcome. In the scientific world, we see this kind of integration where scientists from all over the world are welcome as long as they have some interesting equations to put on the table. And so it should be in civil society. So it's just a question of remembering to defend the roots, the foundation of modern democracy and science and human rights, and not give up on that when we embrace multiculturalism. And that's really the challenge that faces us today.
And finally, Jeff, the role of social media, you have mentioned it, but clearly it heightens tensions and disagreements and leads to what people call fake news.
Well, myself being the victim of really terrible attacks from colleagues on Twitter, I can see how it leads to sort of a pre-Enlightenment mentality, a sort of mob witch hunting mentality that we haven't seen in the West really since the 17th century or maybe the 18th. What I've noticed is that colleagues, former students are willing to use, you know, puke emojis and other vulgar signs on Twitter against me or other colleagues as soon as they make an unpopular argument. Something which they would never do in a conference room. They would never do this in person. They're still governed by the rules of politeness. And so I think social media just gives license to all of our most childish impulses and gives this kind of cover where people's sort of atavistic cells can come out. And I'm hoping that as we learn to live with social media as a society, we're naturally going to do what we did in the 17th century and realize that all this kind of emotionalism is not really good for society, and we can settle back down a bit and learn to be polite, basically, once again.
Well, that seems like an optimistic note to leave you on. Jeff Finball. Yeah, thank you very much indeed for talking to the History Reclaimed podcast website today. I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Bonnie.